I think that when we have scientific ecological knowledge on one hand and indigenous or traditional ecological knowledge on the other, much is made of the differences between them, and they are significant, but they are both human knowledge. And I think what's important in the place that they're reconciled is the knowledge of the land. The land is the teacher. The land is the library of that knowledge. And both scientific knowledge and traditional knowledge are ways to access that knowledge of other beings. And so to me, that's what's really exciting about it, is that the truth of that lies in the land. And so what we really have to do is, from whatever perspective we come from, be better students of the land. And another thing that I would say about that, when you referenced the fact, the way that traditional ecological knowledge is communicated, transmitted, and even generated, that it's a very whole way of knowing. I think about my colleague Greg Cahete, who writes so beautifully about the teachings that you can't understand the things just with your mind. Because as human people, we have our minds, we have emotion, we have body, we have spirit. And if you understand something with only one of those, you understand it incompletely. Whereas the scientific ways of knowing very intentionally privileges the intellect. Not because those other things don't exist, but because that's the epistemology of science. So what I think is so can be so powerful is when you bring these ways of knowing together, learning from the land, all of those ways come together. And then we have a way of thinking that moves people, not just informs them.
I remember meeting Herb Blatchford, a Navajo holy man, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I asked him if it were appropriate for a non-Indian to use Indian stories to illustrate a land ethic. He looked directly into my eyes. That is why they were created. I tried not to waver. Does it offend you? I asked. No, it does not offend me, but it may some. But some have a deeper knowledge than others. It is true that native stories rooted in landscape evoke a sense of integrity, of wonder toward the earth and all its creatures. Animals are given mythic proportion to clarify certain values, attitudes, and lessons. In contrast, animals are not mystified in Anglo tradition. The wolf is stereotyped by Little Red Riding Hood and the Three Little Pigs.
Honorable harvest is a pathway to sustainability, but we know what a slippery word that is. Carol Crow, an Algonquin biologist I know, was going to a conference on sustainable development, and the elders in her community asked her what that was. She offered the standard definitions of sustainability: a means of consuming the resources of the earth in such a way that we do not impair the ability of the earth to provide those same resources to future generations. Sounds good, right? Her elders were very quiet. And finally, one of them said, "That sounds to me like they just want to keep on taking from the earth. Don't they understand that you can't just take? You go to that conference and you tell them that in the way of our people, the first thing we think of should be what can we give? I was taught to reciprocate berries with a gift of my own. It might be leaving a gift of honor or a gift of care, like scattering the seeds or planting the little ones back in the ground so that the plants will flourish after the harvest. I would add one more thing to this list. Defend them fiercely love them so much, you will not let them be lost. This is how we pick berries. This is how indigenous environmental philosophy deals with the question of what is our responsibility in return for the gifts of the earth. And I ask you to consider these teachings from the berries and carry them beyond the berry patch. Imagine social, political, economic decision-making based on the honorable harvest. Imagine a land developer, I like to do this, eyeing a prime parcel of woodland for a housing development. What if he had to ask permission of the forest before converting it to pavement? What if he had to abide by their answer? What if he were mandated to take only what was needed and to give something back in return? We have chosen the policies that we live by, and we can choose again. I'm told that there is an even older teaching, older and more fundamental than take only what you need, and it's take only that which is given to you. Think about it. We already know this. We would not walk into our grandmother's house and start rifling through her cupboards looking for cookies and just take what we want. That would be unthinkable. We wait until she offers us cookies on her favorite china plate. And yet, as a society, we take indiscriminately from the earth whatever we want. We live in the house of Grandmother Earth. We should behave accordingly. Take only that which is given to us is a pretty challenging ethical and practical problem. Some things seem obvious. Berries clearly give themselves to us. With lures of sweetness and color, they beg us to pick them. And by eating them up and dispersing their seeds, we are returning the gift. Both berries and berry pickers benefit by the transaction. They remind us that all flourishing is mutual. And if berries can evolve systems of reciprocity, why not us? Can we extend the concept of the honorable harvest to address the environmental challenges that we face today? Coal from mountaintop removal. That is not given to us. Tar sands oil that destroy the land is not given to us. Shale gas from hydrofracking that poisons water so we can have more things to throw away is clearly not given to us. But the sun's energy is given to us every day. Every day the wind blows and the surf rolls. These are given to us freely and limitless in supply, although not without their own cost. Take only that which is given could be a key part of a sustainable energy policy. We human people have a moral obligation to the future, to our grandchildren, and to the earth herself. And that obligation seems so difficult to exercise when we're made to feel powerless by the actions of multinational corporations, big money, unresponsive political systems. But you and I, we are not powerless. The teachings of the honorable harvest did not disappear with the buffalo. They're even more compelling now as then. We may not be able to directly stop a mining company or the poisoners of water, but we do have control over our own honor. We can reclaim the ethic of the honorable harvest. We can choose to ask permission and listen to the answer. We can choose to take only what we need and to use respectfully whatever we have taken. We can choose not to consume things which are dishonorably harvested. We can follow the lead of the berries and demand that our economic system be aligned with ecological laws and human values. We could choose to be grateful recipients instead of mindless thieves. And in this way, you and I together can live with honor and sustain the lives of those that sustain ours.
Think about what is what are humans, who are we as people in relationship to the rest of the living world, I turn back to the phrasing of my Haudenosaunee neighbors who say, human people are the younger brothers of creation, younger brothers and younger sisters of creation. We haven't been here nearly as long as the plants. The plants have figured out how to live here, and we haven't yet. We're still working on that.
Can we reimagine ourselves in place in a different way of being in the world? Still holding on to the essentials of what we love and what we will fight for, land health, wildness, a livable future. We know that our institutions are no longer serving us. We have the opportunity to reimagine ourselves in the 21st century. Our governments, our schools, our religious institutions, even ourselves, especially ourselves, to imagine, reimagine, recompose ourselves in place, deeply rooted, deeply engaged, brave, home. It is time for us to return home.
And I used to work actively in the field of restoration ecology until, after spending time with wounded landscapes, as all of us do, I began to understand again, I began to remember that it's not the land that's broken, it's our relationship to land that's broken, which is why we propagate these wounded sites all over the landscape over and over again. And so I began to rethink my work as a restoration ecologist to be thinking about healing our relationship to land. And scientific tools have such great power for healing or for engaging, restoring ecosystem structure and function. But I think that it's the language of the heart and of the spirit, which are present in traditional ecological knowledge and indigenous knowledge, that have some of the power to heal that relationship. I also want to say that when I speak of the indigenous worldview, it's really an organic worldview. It's the worldview of people who are close to the land, who listen to the land, who understand the world as gift and are fed by that land. A good colleague of mine says that we shouldn't be calling it indigenous knowledge. We should be calling it naturalized knowledge, the knowledge of natural people, because we are all indigenous to some place and hope to be indigenous to the place that we live, to live as if we were indigenous. Speaking of restoration, with the advent of these tools of molecular genetics that Stan spoke so well of this morning, there is much conversation, of course, around this notion of de-extinction, of bringing back the species we have destroyed, of regenerating the genotypes of mastodons and passenger pigeons. But didn't Martha's loneliness teach us something? That without her community, without the communal breeding, without the closeness of other wings, recovery was impossible. That a species is more than a genome, that an individual is more than a species, that beings need to belong together to flourish, and that to be the only remnant without any context at all is an exercise in loneliness. I don't think that we need to fix other species. I think the species we need to fix is ourselves. The loneliness that we need to address is our own, our species' loneliness. When we have isolated ourselves from the knowledge of our non-human teachers, the regard of our more-than-human kinfolk, If we are to devote our energies to de-extinction, let it be to the de-extinction of a worldview, a de-extinction of knowledge. Let us de-extinct and therefore renew a way of living with the world that engages compassion, wisdom, justice, and joy.
I have been delighted with the responses to this question of what does the earth ask of us. In particular, people's response to the simple framing of the question, to the acknowledgement that there is agency and responsibility, that the earth does ask something of us, as opposed to us always asking what more can we take from the earth. And the responses have been so wide-ranging, from artists to scientists. And one of the ones that I like a great deal is this notion that the earth asks us to follow the rules that all the other species follow, that nature has not repealed the laws of thermodynamics. You really can't just take without giving back. That our economic system needs to be aligned with those ecological principles. I think the earth asks us, and I would say a consensus among many of the other thinkers about this, is that the earth asks us to play by the rules, to consider ourselves as a member of this whole community. And that gets us into the realm of thinking about how to reimagine ourselves outside of human exceptionalism.
How do you think of hope when we're wrestling with these large questions?
I think it's easy to feel despair when you do pay attention to the living world and see all of those losses. But despair is a way of accepting powerlessness. And I think that we have to engage hope. And one of the links, I think, between despair and engaging hope and moving forward is actually grief. To look at those wounds of the world and really feel them. Native peoples with their great history of loss on Turtle Island, our cultures which are familiar with the grief of loss of that living world, but that grief opens the door to healing. I think you have to really feel it in order to recognize how much you would miss what you love when it's gone. And we take so much for granted, and we don't miss it until we don't have it anymore. But to really feel that grief, to feel the love that you have for a place, I think can also propel hope. And I think that one of the most powerful things that does impel hope and impel our work to the future is putting your hands in the ground. Is recognizing that while our leaders may not be leading, we can lead. And if our leaders won't do the right thing, we have to do the right thing. And that we as individuals, we as a collective, can kind of reclaim our own honor about the way that we take from the earth and what we give to the earth. And that creates a movement. And I have a lot of faith in my neighbors, both human and non. But not to sit back, to act out of that love, to act out of that grief, and say that I will fiercely defend everything that's left to me. And to me, that's where my hope comes from. I think people will do that. They already are. Ooh.
In the Potawatomi language, we call these beautiful berries Odemin, the heart berry. We acknowledge them as the leaders of the berry people, for they're the first to give us their fruits in the summer. In the language I was born to, we call them strawberries. And in the language I've learned as a scientist, we call them by the Latin binomial Fragaria virginiana. And in all three languages, they are so sweet. I'm a scientist, a plant ecologist, and also a student, just a beginner, of our traditional teachings. My understanding of the world lies at the intersection of two great ways of knowing, between science and indigenous knowledge. And in scientific ways of thinking, these berries are the reproductive structures of a distinct species, a vital component of the food web. In indigenous ways of thinking, we recognize them as the berry people, who are persons, non-human persons, with their own intrinsic roles in the democracy of species. These are sovereign beings with their own intelligences, their own wisdom, their own responsibilities. Berries as persons. In some nations, as you know, the rights of all species are enshrined in the Constitution because they are people. In U.S. law, corporations are granted the status of people, while berries are without any right at all. I ask you, what corporation gives you wild strawberries on a summer morning? By any measure, when you put one in your mouth, you know that wild strawberries are a gift, all wrapped in red and green. The natural world is a source of gifts, not commodities, but gifts. Berries are given to us by the plants themselves. In fact, in our language, the Potawatomi word for berry, min, is very closely related to our word for giving gifts, minidawag. Giving a gift is to be as a berry. How we think about our relationship to the living world matters deeply. It is our moral imagination that will shape our futures as much as any technology or policy. When something is understood as a gift instead of a commodity, a door opens. An opening to the potential for reciprocity. And much of mainstream culture has chosen to see the earth as property. But we could choose differently. We, you and I together, we could choose to live in a world made of gifts. And as human people, we are showered daily with gifts from Shakmakwe, Mother Earth. And the question we face as non-photosynthetic, lamentably, beings is how do we respond to the gifts of the Earth? How can we be ecological consumers, as we must, in a way that honors those gifts? We have only to look around us at the wounds we have inflicted on the Earth to know that we don't yet have that answer. And where will we find a teacher for this most pressing question of our time, when our actions have brought creation to the brink of a massive wave of extinction, when we stand at the edge of a climate precipice? And in my culture, plants are known not only as people, but as our teachers, our oldest teachers. After all, they've been here far longer than we have. They know how to fulfill their responsibilities, while we human people are still trying to figure it out. They know how to build soil, recycle water, create homes for endless other beings. They give us the very air we breathe. They know how to make berries out of light. We might do well to listen. And if berries are our teachers, what are they telling us? In our ceremonies, we honor the berries by passing them in a bowl for everybody in the circle to share. And they remind us of the teachings known as the one bowl, one spoon, that the earth is as one bowl, filled with everything that we need. A bowl with finite capacity. When it's empty, it's empty. And there's just one spoon, the same one for all of us, for humans and for the more than humans alike. There cannot be a teaspoon for some people and a power shovel for others. So say the berries.
Knowledge of alternative food plants. When we see that our subsistence patterns and many of our dominant crops are going to be moving away, you know there are 250,000 of flowering plants out there. And Western society eats how many? Do you know? Three dominant ones, three are way at the top. It's about 10. It's about 10 species. But of course, we know in indigenous life ways lots of other foods and ways of taking care of those foods as well. This is valuable knowledge for the time ahead.
Our honor requires us to educate, motivate, and activate each other to reject business as usual. Business which is stealing possibility from humans and bears and salmon and berries alike. When as individuals we act with honor, we can create a social movement more powerful than corporations. We set our feet on a path to create what beloved clan mother Audrey Shenandoah called justice not only for ourselves, but justice for all of creation. For the bowl of berries, which is the earth, to be refilled, we must also reclaim our roles as givers to the earth. We say that gifts and responsibilities are two sides of the same coin. Birds were given the gift of song, so it's their responsibility to greet the day. Stars were given the gift of sparkle, and therefore the duty to guide our way at night. What are our gifts as human people? We can't fly. We can't breathe underwater. We can't even photosynthesize. We have the gift of choice, of story, of gratitude, of love, of hands that make ingenious tools and transformative art. We can put our hands into the earth, restoring the damage that we have done, healing the land the way the plants have shown us to. It's not the land that's broken, but our relationship to land. We can heal that, you and I, together. It starts by asking ourselves, what will I give in return for the gifts of the earth? In return for the gift of berries? In return for the privilege of breath? Mi'iu, mi'kwech.